The truth is that we are in a climate emergency. We have less than 10 years to make substantial changes to our society and way of life and our economy.
I want to stress from the outset that this pandemic is far from over.
Those who have never fought for the colours they fly should be careful about criticising those who have.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. Well, good afternoon. I'm Caroline Hepke. Now, looking at the budget tomorrow, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak is expected to announce that the public sector pay freeze will come to an end next year. More than 2 million workers, including firefighters, police and teachers, were affected by that pay freeze that came into force last April. The Chancellor is also expected to announce an increase in the national minimum wage to £9.50 per hour. It means the Chancellor has trailed now more than £31 billion of spending. But will coronavirus restrictions take another bite out of the economy? Boris Johnson was warned that a switch to stricter coronavirus Plan B rules would cost the economy as much as £18 billion. That's according to Politico, citing government documents that they've seen. Plan B, of course, involves mandatory face masks, vaccine passports and working from home. Well, in a moment, we'll hear from the Institute for Public Policy Research and from Deloitte about the budget from the Chancellor tomorrow. But first, joining me now is Katie Clark, the Labour member of the Scottish Parliament for the West of Scotland, also a life peer. Baroness Clark, welcome to the programme. Katie, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
A long-awaited pay rise then could be about to come for millions of public sector workers from the budget. That's a good thing, surely?
It is a good thing. I suspect it won't be enough, given that the public sector has had wage constraints for so many years now, and wages have gone down so much in real terms. But obviously, compared with a pay freeze, an increase is very welcome indeed.
The Chancellor's got to balance the books, though, and although borrowing is perhaps less than forecast, it is still enormous in the UK in the wake of the pandemic.
Yes, and public sector pays obviously only a very, very small part of that. And, you know, the people that we've relied on during the pandemic are our key workers in the public sector, people in the National Health Service and local councils and transport, all the people that we lauded and clapped so much during the height of the pandemic and the lockdown. And really, you know, those are not the people that should be paying the price for the economic problems surrounding the pandemic and COVID-19.
Okay. How can you have a high skills, high wage economy, though, in the UK and it not have an impact on the public finances? That's the real worry. It's one thing to, for example, support with the furlough scheme and so on, but it's comes at a cost eventually.
It does come at a cost, yes. And this has been an absolutely massive economic challenge for the UK, you know, similar to something like the World War, you know, that we remember from, you know, World War II. I think we have to look at it in that way. You know, we have got the highest figure outside of wartime in terms of, you know, government borrowing, and we have to recognise that. But the question is, well, how do we, you know, build back? How do we rebuild the country? And how do we do that in a way that is fair for everybody in society? What's happened throughout the pandemic is that actually the gap between rich and poor has got greater. Those with the broadest shoulders have actually comparatively done quite well during the pandemic. That's both people that are working in well-paid jobs, but also, you know, the multinationals. Whilst the poorest have been the people that have paid the biggest price. So, you know, as we come out of the pandemic, and unfortunately it's far from over, but as we, you know, move forward, then we need to make sure that we address that inequality and that we look after those that actually create the wealth in this country and that we've relied on during the pandemic. So, you know, in terms of public policy, we need to think about how we actually build back in a way that helps everybody in society to build the kind of strong economy that we need going forward.
OK, Plan B, should there be more restrictions given the pressures from mounting COVID cases, although they've taken a little bit of a pause in terms of the increase, but they remain very, very high? I mean, there are warnings about what kind of economic damage that would, you know, reap. But, you know, the human toll is huge too. Plan B, should it happen now?
well, I think some of these restrictions shouldn't have been taken away. I'm sitting in Edinburgh at the moment, and of course, for example, mask wearing is far more widespread in Scotland because it's legally required in many settings where it's no longer required in England. So I, you know, think that there has to be a recognition that removing, for example, masks probably wasn't the way to go and is linked, you know, to the rise in coronavirus cases. We should be led by the science in this. We need to look at the medical evidence. And if the medical evidence is, for example, that it's safer that people use masks in certain settings, then I believe that's something that should be put in place by government. And so, yes, there should be a plan B.
OK. Scotland has got its own powers in terms of imposing additional restrictions. Would you encourage the Holyrood government to do that now?
I think perhaps what we should focus on is actually enforcement of the rules that we have. So, for example, if you travel around on a train in Scotland, there's more people wearing masks than in England. But even though it's legally required, there's still a lot of people not wearing masks. So my view would be we should focus on enforcing the restrictions that we currently have to start with before extending restrictions. But also, you know, a lot of it's about education and people using common sense and recognising when they're in a situation that's more high risk and, for example, putting on a mask because they recognise that that may be required in terms of social distancing requirements. So I would say, you know, it's two-pronged. You know, in terms of Scotland, it should be about actually enforcing regulations that are there already and making sure there's a higher compliance level, but also, you know, actually making sure that people are aware of the risks and therefore make decisions that are based on common sense decisions.
How is the booster rollout going where you are?
Well, for whatever reason, it's not going as well as, for example, in England. The vaccination programme for 12 to 15-year-olds is going very well in Scotland. There's a far higher level of 12 to 15-year-olds that have been vaccinated. But the booster programme itself isn't going as well in Scotland. Now, it's very difficult to get the answer as to why that is, whether it's because the focus has gone into the teenagers getting vaccinated and therefore there's been less focus on the booster, less resources put into that. But for whatever reason, it's simply, you know, not working as well in Scotland as it is in other parts of the UK, and that's something that the Scottish Government needs to address.
OK. Scotland's health secretary, as reported by The Times, says that the booster programme in Scotland is on track.
Well, I suppose it depends what your targets are. But, you know, the figures suggest that, well, you know, for example, booster jabs have been offered to over 60s in Scotland and those with high risk of infection and to care home residents and to frontline health and social care services. It's not been offered to some of the other groups, for example, the over 50s that have been offered it in England. So the targets are different in Scotland and they're less ambitious.
OK, so that on COVID and the booster rollout. You also want to see, though, you know, going back to the sort of issues that we may all face in the UK in terms of what happens this winter, winter fuel supplement. You want more to be done on that in terms of preventing the cost of living crisis. Can government afford to do it? You know, who would pay for that again?
Well, other countries are doing it. Other countries are trying to assist particularly the most vulnerable who are most likely to be in fuel poverty to cope with, you know, the rising international prices of fuel. So, you know, if you look around Europe, then that's exactly what's happening in other countries. I mean, I think, for example, one of the things that, you know, the government could do in the budget tomorrow is take away the 5% VAT that we get on our electricity and gas bills at the moment. They could look at increasing, you know, the targeted support for those who get help with their fuel bills because of the fact that they're in fuel poverty. So, you know, if we don't do this, then we're going to see a lot more people die and you know, suffer other illnesses as a result of, you know, the cold that we know is a problem in all parts of the UK every year, but obviously is worse in the north and in Scotland. So, you know, I think, you know, these things have to be priorities for government. And I suppose, you know, going back to some of the conversation we had at the beginning about the top lines of the government and of the budget, then the issue really is about whose side this government is on. Is it on the side of the wealthy, of those that have power, or is it about actually trying to redistribute the huge, you know, inequalities of wealth and power in this country? And during a pandemic, we've actually seen the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. Tomorrow is an opportunity for the government to address that and put measures in place that reverse that trend, that, mm-hmm. you know, put in place the kind of measures that we need, you know, as we discuss the COP26 climate change debate over the coming weeks, that both address the climate challenge, but also the, you know, the huge inequality of wealth and power that we have in this country in a way that actually builds the economy and builds the wealth that we have for all of us to share.
Okay, Kate, just very briefly then, before we end, on that front, should Sunak be spending more in this budget then, briefly?
I don't think he has a choice but to do that given the situation that we're in. You know, the only way that we can, you know, address the crises that we face is through investment. That's both the crisis in terms of our public services, in terms of, you know, the NHS, which is on its knees, the other public services that have faced such massive challenges due to COVID. The only way that we're going to address the climate challenge is through investment. And indeed, the only way that we're going to address the COVID pandemic is through investment, for example, in tackling issues such as the appalling rates of statutory sick pay that we have in this country, which are so much lower than other countries.
Now, let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics. So the Treasury must detail how it will fund its ambitious plans to decarbonise the economy in the coming decades. That, according to the Climate Change Committee, the government's own independent advisers. The UK's net zero strategy, published last week, is both achievable and affordable, they say, and it sets a positive example ahead of COP26, but it needs more. The Treasury needs to set out how it will use the tax system to help the energy transition and fill the fiscal hole that it will leave. Meanwhile, the Common Standards Committee says that the Conservative MP Owen Paterson should be suspended for 30 days over an egregious case of paid advocacy. The investigation by the watchdog found that the former Tory minister repeatedly used his privileged position to lobby on behalf of two companies. Any suspension will have to be voted on by MPs. And lastly, there's a backlog of more than 2 million cancer patients in the UK. The Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry is warning that the UK must restart clinical trials and research for cancer patients quickly to avoid more delays. One in six cancer patients receive treatment through clinical trials. So those are some of the stories in the world of politics. And now, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak will deliver the budget on Wednesday after Prime Minister's questions around 12:30 p.m. But we already have many of the details expected, including plans to give an extra £5.9 billion to the NHS to reduce those waiting lists and to increase the national living wage. George Dibb, the head of the Institute for Public Policy Research's Centre for Economic Justice, spoke to me about what he expects to see in the budget. Have a listen.
I think you're absolutely right that the Chancellor has made some quite significant announcements over the weekend, and his ambitions are absolutely in the right place. So targeting this high-wage, high-investment, green and productive economy is what we should be concerned about. But I also worry that he might not be putting in place either the policies or the investments that are actually needed to get us there. So you raised the question of the increase in the national minimum wage. I think it's really important. IPPR has been calling for an increase to the minimum wage for some time. The increase, it brings it up to the level of the real living wage outside London, and that will be a welcome increase for many people. Although I would caution two things. Firstly, those on universal credit, who of course are on the lowest wages and saw a massive reduction in their pay, in their income, just a couple of weeks ago, will not see the entirety of that minimum wage increase, and that's because pay is the universal credit is tapered. So of that 59 pence per hour increase, they will only see a 22 pence per hour increase. And secondly, I would say that minimum wage is, of course, welcome for those on the absolute lowest incomes. But it's not the answer of how we can transform the UK economy into a high-wage, high-productivity system, which is what we should really be worrying about. And to get us there, you need to be investing in, or rather the Chancellor needs to be investing in, the UK's productive economy. It needs to be investing in the sources of future growth, like innovation and research and development. And he needs to be investing in the skills of lifelong education of people in the workforce, because that's how we're actually going to transform the economy to one which is high pay in the future.
Yeah, but that's such a long-term pursuit. And the issue is higher wages, more inflation. And that's a real problem for the UK economy. You could kind of spiral into stagflation.
Well, I think it is, of course, a long-term pursuit. But now is the time to put those building blocks and those foundations in place. We're coming out of one of the biggest financial shocks the UK economy has ever seen. And also, people out there in the country want to see this too. Polling shows that people don't want to go back to the economy we had before. So I think now is the right moment for Rishi Sunak to be starting to put in place some big transformational policies. You raised the question of inflation. I think that is a concern, although I think we could also continue to learn from the example being set by the Biden administration in the US, where they're setting out a really significant infrastructure investment, which is going to be creating jobs and boosting the productive side of the economy. And in that case, we're not so worried about inflation, because inflation is caused by shortages. If we're creating new jobs and productive capacity in the economy, that will be boosting the output as well.
Okay. What about the money that's going, the extra funding to the NHS? Will that help to plug the gap when it comes to health inequality, or is it simply a bit of catch-up?
Well, the money that has been announced over the weekend is, first of all, it's very tricky to say whether this is new money or not yet, because we haven't seen the policy documents to back it up, which, of course, is the challenge when the numbers are leaked the weekend before the spending review. But if this is new money, I think it is welcome. It's going to go on capital, so on new equipment, new buildings and maintenance of existing hospitals. And we know that for a long time this has been underinvested in the NHS and in the UK. So addressing that now is really welcome. Although I would question whether that's actually what's needed to really remedy the substantial health inequalities across the country. And that's partly because it's not going to go on day-to-day spending. So it's not going to boost the number of doctors and nurses. It's not, if we're going to buy lots of new equipment and repair hospitals, which of course is important, we're not going to increase the number of people who's actually working there to use them. And I'd also highlight that if the Chancellor's approach has been to fund that by taking money away from somewhere else, take it away from local council budgets, or take it away from other health budgets, that might just increase longer-term pressures in the NHS overall. We know that what we need to address is social care in the UK. That's a massive priority. We think that there should be a social care-led recovery. And the NHS and social care levy, which was announced a few weeks ago, the increase in national insurance contributions, that will all go to the NHS for the first 3 years. So there seems to be a bit of a black hole in the announcement so far. Perhaps we'll see something when the Chancellor signs up tomorrow. But we think that we need to see more funding going towards social care right now. In fact, we would like to see something on the level of £11 billion every year for the next 3 years, announcing the spending review, going into fixing our social care system. And that will, of course, then further lighten the load on the NHS as well, because we know that if you cut budgets elsewhere, that often ends up being impacted onto the healthcare system.
That was the IPPR. But crucial will be whether the Chancellor raises taxes. Here's Amanda Tickle, the head of tax and trade policy at Deloitte.
Of course, this is a budget and spending review. And I have to say, so far, it's shaping up to be more about spending than budget. We've seen an unusual number of early announcements, actually, in the past few days, money for the NHS, education and transport. So, as you say, we'll have to wait for the detail of how this is actually going to be funded on Wednesday. But, you know, turning to tax specifically, overall, our prediction is this time it will be more good news than bad. We don't expect significant tax rises tomorrow. And this is because we already had three big tax raises announced this year. Of course, you know, going back to the budget in March, we saw freezing of the personal allowances for income tax. And then we had that quite surprise announcement that corporation tax is going to jump up from 19 to 25% from 2023. And then just a few weeks ago, completely outside of the budget cycle, we had this new health and social care levy. which applies to employees, employers and dividends. And collectively, those three rises are supposed to be raising at least $28 billion by 2023-24. So I think with the economic recovery under consumer confidence a bit precarious in our view, the limit for raising more tax has probably been reached. We'll see some small areas addressed, but we actually think it's going to be more of a focus on investment and attractiveness of the UK for foreign investors.
Okay, interesting. I mean, you and your team, as you look at the potential tax implications, and of course your view there, as you've stated, is that they probably don't have room, or at least they're not going to go for any substantial hikes in this spending review or budget. Are there changes, though, to the structure of the tax system here in the UK that could be unveiled?
Yeah, I think there are. I think there's probably three areas that we should watch for. And the first is just going back to what I was saying. I think this government is very interested in how attractive the UK is for foreign investors, very keen to see an uptick in foreign direct investment. They have been trying to woo international investors into the UK with various summits and initiatives. So lately we've seen flagged changes to the tonnage tax regime. It's quite a niche area, but it's the shipping industry specialist tax system, which they can adopt, which means that they're taxed on how much they carry rather than just on the profits they make. So they're going to change, we think they're going to change some of the regime around there to attract more ships to register in the UK. Secondly, there's also a consultation that we think is going to happen on re-domiciliation to bring more business headquarters to the UK. And the one reduction we do think is going to happen is to the bank surcharge. Now, this is a tax on top of the normal corporation tax that is actually paid in addition by banks. It's currently 8%, and it's already been flagged that it will be reduced given corporate tax is going up. So we think that's going to go down by about 5 or 6% to try and keep the financial services sector competitive. So that's all about attractiveness. And then the other areas that we think we'll see change are really to encourage more private sector investment. Of course, we've got COP26 next week, and the government really needs private sector to get behind innovation to reduce carbon emissions and achieve net zero. So we think there might be some more focused incentive schemes that could be announced on Wednesday.
Okay, interesting. Just very briefly, Amanda, before we let you go, we're running down the clock a bit, but do we expect that spending cuts are going to be off the table at this budget?
I think they're going to have to balance things up. We have already seen flagged that there'll be some departments that have been asked to take cuts, and there have been quite a lot of spending announcements early. So I think we're just going to have to see which areas are going to have to take some cuts in order to accommodate that spending, because, of course, we have got, or the Chancellor has got, a huge debt of around $400 billion in addition to manage as a result of spending on the pandemic. So I don't think there'll be no cuts.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.